Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Diversity American Style with Chuck Ashman, only on LA Talk Radio.
I would like to brag about my athletic achievements at this time. It's somewhat limited. My glory is having spent a lot of time on the bench for the Coral Gables High School basketball team. As a result, I get excited when I meet a superstar. I met Sandy Koufax. That should have been enough for anybody. I've met and know Joe Namath, Arnold Palmer, and my friend Mark Spitz. Not a bad roster of I met. A couple of decades ago, I met a man best known as the greatest tennis player ever to come from Asia. At one time or another, he beat them all. Add to that his senior tennis, a remarkable business career, a broadcast sensation with everything from an hour with Donald Trump to calling the shots in Wimbledon and the biggest television audience anybody could ever have, all of Asia, parts of Asia. And you have the gentleman here with me, who I'm proud to call a good friend for many years. So much so that I remember the day when some newspaper printed that India needed a new face and that the right man to be president of India would be Vijay Armitage. I had not figured out how he would commute from Southern California to the office every morning if he were elected. He was not elected, but everything else that we've talked about has been achieved and achieved and achieved. Now, to be perfectly transparent, I will confess to having one gripe, one annoying complaint, one irritation with this man, and I've tried to shake it, and I can't, frankly. He looks so damn good and dresses so well that they cast him with Roger Moore in Octopussy, the 007 movie, and worse than that, my wife, the first time she met him, said, "Why can't you dress like that?" And I don't want to deal with why can't you dress like that. So there. Vijay, you are the ultimate world traveler. I should have mentioned, I remember the time so well when the United Nations designated you as a messenger of peace and you went to Pakistan with soccer balls. I remember that. I remember they sent you not to India but to Pakistan, which in and of itself was a diplomatic coup. So you are the perfect person to give us a true picture, since you travel so much, of how others think of Americans. Now, you immediately come across as Indian and very American. As you travel the world, how are we as a nation, as a people, perceived in India and elsewhere where you go?
Well, first of all, let me start, Chuck, by saying I thought when you started the introduction, you were talking about someone else.
Right. Okay.
So I'm looking around the room, looking for that person.
There you go.
But I appreciate all that you said. I mean, we've known each other a long time, and certainly have had a variety of roles in different arenas. But I think the one thing I enjoy most of all is my travel, the education I get from it, and what it teaches me to be able to be sort of globe-trotting in different cultures and different religions and different ethnicities and different way people think. And at the end of the day, it all comes down to family and how does a family think. And I always believe that the family in Stockholm and Sydney and Tokyo and Tashkent and Bombay and Boston all want the same thing at the end of the day. And that's the advantage of travel, where you get to see what they truly want. But coming back to your question as to what the rest of the world thinks of the United States, there is no question about the fact that the U.S. is where we actually get to watching what the U.S. does before the rest of the world tends to follow it. As a matter of fact, even within the U.S., I would probably venture to say it starts in California and then starts to go eastward and then gets to the U.K. and Europe and then eventually into India and Asia. And then whether it's a Starbucks or whether it's anything else, it just kind of gets there starting in California.
Very interesting observation. I think you're right on the flow. Would I see a Starbucks the minute I landed in New Delhi?
Yes, at the airport.
Wouldn't have to leave the airport. The most recent or a recent part of your career in so many fascinating ways successful has been your broadcast career and the show that you do periodically with long-form interviews, one of which was 60 Minutes with Donald Trump, which no one else had. And I noticed that immediately after the election, it appeared a lot, a lot in Asia.
Yes, it did. It was one of those very interesting moments because I got to speak with him, obviously, before he decided to run for president, but we did have a word on it. And he was terrific. It was an hour one-on-one, and I was at Trump Tower in his just outside in the conference room, I think, where he did The Apprentice.
Right.
And, of course, he's a great sports fan. He had seen me playing, and obviously that was a great attachment that he had to tennis and football and all other sports. He still likes playing tennis and golf. So I think we're back to using the tennis court at the White House.
There you go. Since President-elect Trump has brought up rigged elections, he's still talking about it. He has been called by Anderson Cooper, great name. He's a sore winner. In sports, there's no place for that. Now, I have a little fixed election selection intelligence about you, and you can plead guilty or not guilty. Is it true, Mr. Armitage, that when they decided to put you in Octopussy with Roger Moore, that they arranged for you to do a cameo on Fantasy Island so that they could get around some issues on union and money and have you do the movie? You were not the little guy that said, the plane. I don't, you're too tall for that, but is that a true story?
I was too tall to play Ricardo Montalban.
Right.
But yes, they flew me back to Los Angeles, and our dear friend Lenny Goldberg, who produced the show, got me on to do a cameo on Fantasy Island, which I really, really enjoyed. And then I was a member of SAG. And that was it.
And therefore,
I went
you keep
back
going.
And did the Bond picture, went on to do Star Trek, of course, The Voyage Home, and really enjoyed my performance. I mean, rather my acting career, which was a lot of fun to do. I did a lot of guest appearances thereafter.
Well, let me say this about your acting career. It was interesting.
DOA?
It was interesting. You created an interesting character. Didn't you do one with Chuck, too? With
yes,
Carlos?
Yes, I did Walker, Texas Ranger. I had a couple of television series of my own, too.
I remember that.
With an ensemble cast, which was just terrific to do because live audience always kind of tickles my fancy.
Yeah, well, tell me about the periodic television interviews. That's rather remarkable, including some of the people you've interviewed.
Yes, we were very fortunate, actually, to get people all the way from, obviously, now President-elect Trump to the great or the wonderful and very interesting to talk to Hugh Hefner from The Mansion. We did Wolfgang Puck in Food, of course, a master of food. We did Sugar Ray Leonard, Oscar De La Hoya.
Any tennis players?
We did Agassi and Graf together from Las Vegas.
Oh, my.
John McEnroe, Jimmy Connors. My buddies, of course, and it was really exciting to do the show because it gave me even more of an insight as to what these people go through to get to where they were.
There's a big issue right now before the Congress, before the American people, and I'm not sure the mindset has found itself. There's confusion about our foreign trade, our international trade, our relationships with Asia, Pacific Rim nations, other places. Now, you are involved now beyond the borders of India in multiple industries, in sports, in entertainment, and in technology. What is your vision for what will be happening there in Asia and the American economy? Do you see us each doing our own thing? Carrier announced yesterday, we're not going to send the jobs out of the country. We're going to do it here. I personally, if I analyzed the phone calls I've made on credit cards, bank accounts, and miscellaneous things in the past year, would venture to say half were from India. The other half were a combination of either the U.S. or somewhere else. Is that going to change, or is that a good thing, a bad thing? Where do you see it?
Well, I think, first of all, if you look at the macro picture and look at the world as a whole, obviously today we're living in an interconnected world. We're living in a global economy. What happens in New York affects what happens in London and Bombay and Hong Kong on the index. I think we're going to have to look at it, first of all, from that direction. Secondly, of course, the need for people in certain positions and in certain, especially in tech jobs, where you have to have a qualified person in that particular role. And you might or might not have it domestically. You might have to bring it in. It's no different from in medicine, where countries of the world that don't have the right medical equipment have to bring it in from someplace else. So I think these kinds of things are in place as we look at it, look at the world and the economy. The TPPs and the Asia partnerships and the World Trade Agreements and WTO and all of that really comes down to all the details that people would know better than I would. But at the end of the day, I think we are, in fact, living in a global world, and in a global economy. It is very important. The United States is always going to be a dominant market. It's what, some $16, $18 trillion economy. It's way ahead of any other country in the world. Everyone would try to get into the U.S. market to sell their goods. So I think these things are, in fact, going to be of great importance. And you want to give the American consumer the best that you can give him at the right possible price.
I find it really interesting early morning to be listening to the radio, and more often than not, the market was down 2 points today in reaction to talk in Britain about leaving the EU. The market was down 3 points today as a result of the Japanese failing to... Excuse me, I didn't vote on that.
Yes.
You know. Does the other work as well? If something happens here, did the election of Trump, for example, impact one way or the other the economy in India?
Well, there was certainly a lot of talk about it. Obviously, the American election is arguably the longest election we've ever seen any part of the world.
Right.
But obviously, the one thing that the rest of the world followed very closely prior to the U.S. election was Britain's exit from the EU.
Sure.
Needless to say, the pound dropped. The value of the pound went down compared to other currencies.
How is that affecting Asia, good or bad?
Well, it brings in a lot more tourists into the UK.
Yeah.
Because the pound is weaker.
Right.
So it makes it a big difference.
Does that pull tourism from Asia, maybe?
Yes, absolutely. And British goods are also cheaper in the rest of the world. So it made a big difference. But when you look at what the American election was all about and what the conversations was all about and what the pollsters were all about, and you talk about the fact that literally the Democratic candidate was going to be a shoo-in to win the election,
right,
and everyone was anticipating and expecting it in every part of the world, that no one expected what happened to happen.
Right.
And so when it did happen, what happened? The market actually went up.
I know.
The stock market went up something like 3%.
Yeah.
And that was not expected again. So I think when we look at it in its overall, I think when the dust settles, it'll really be honestly fine when the rest of the world looks at us.
I think there is one interesting, particularly Indian-related, and that is President-elect Trump has made it clear in a great many speeches that, as far as other nations are concerned, you're either our friend or you're not. And the help and the financial and the support and the camaraderie is going to go with those who are. And India has maintained that. And to be fair, the other great population center that's slightly ahead of you, but you're moving, is China. And the opposite is true. China may buy anything and everything they want in this country. They've got a lot of money. But the attitude toward China, the attitude is just not comparable. Would you agree that it is to India?
Yes. First of all, we are the world's largest democracy.
Right.
It is an amazing election that takes place once every 5 years in my country that is quite spectacular. I can't even start to venture to say how many polling booths there are in our country to service a billion.
Are they all in one language?
Population, 1.3 billion. No, it's not. It's in local languages.
So
we have a lot of languages, we have dialects, we have all kinds of issues across the country. But it is run magnificently. And the last election we had two years ago, without incident, it was just wonderful to see. One thing what I'm really, really proud of. So the thing about India and the largest democracy in the world is that we've gotten along with all administrations in Washington.
Yes.
And to a great extent, historically, it's been more with the Democrats. But again, since the time of our good friend, former President H.W. Bush, after he took over from President Reagan, the Republicans really made a big push to be able to be even more friendly with the country. So I think as far as we're concerned, I feel very strongly about the fact that India will get along with whichever party is in the White House.
Oh, I think very clearly that, and get along better, I think, than other countries. Go back to what you mentioned about the multiple languages and dialects. I find that remarkable, interesting, fascinating, and a little scary. I mean, how do you cross the borders within a country doing business if you don't speak the same language?
Well, look at it this way. If you landed in Delhi tomorrow morning, you'll be fine with English.
Oh, okay.
So you'll be fine.
But
English is a national language.
That's Delhi.
No, all across the country.
Oh, okay.
English is fine. It's a national language. Hindi is also a national language.
Right.
So we have two national languages.
That's two.
But we have a lot of state languages, like the state that I come from in the southern part of India, an equivalent of what would be Florida here on the southeastern coast of India. It's called Tamil Nadu,
which is
Madras,
the city
it used
of Madras.
To be Madras.
Right.
And now it's called Chennai. And we speak Tamil. If you went from Chennai to Bangalore, which is in the state of Karnataka, just north of us, or to the east of us, or rather to the west of us, it would be Kannada. But we both speak English, and we'd be fine.
So English is almost ubiquitous throughout the country?
Yes, it is absolutely fine throughout the country.
And in trade, do they use English?
It's a commonly used language,
rather
yes.
than Hindi. What about the politics? Is it a national election as we know it? They pick the most popular guy and he becomes president?
Okay, so you well know that we were governed by British rule till 1947.
Right.
We gained independence on August 15th, 1947, and then we became a republic the following year. So we have a ceremonial post, which is the president of India, like the Queen of England.
Right.
But we have a parliamentary system of democracy in India. We have some 500-plus members of parliament, and the majority party that wins in parliament has its leader as the prime minister.
Right.
And the prime minister runs the government. The president, of course, is in their ceremonial post. By the constitution, he can fire the prime minister, obviously, which he doesn't do, but the prime minister literally kind of selects the president.
Are the issues that have been around for so many years between Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, are they going through a period of calm, a period of tension? Are they over? What is the status? I think Americans are confused.
Well, I think you have to look at both countries independently, and we've certainly had our independence. We've obviously never had a coup. We've never had a military ruler in our country. It's all been by elections, obviously. Pakistan has had its share of issues. I think the people of Pakistan, the people of India get along extremely well wherever they meet in any part of the world, and certainly even across borders. A lot of people from India migrated there and vice versa before independence. So I think when you look at the two countries themselves in population, both countries as peoples get along very well. I think it's very, very important for neighbors to be able to also deal in trade. And I think trade and also being able to have communication through sport, through music, through film, through art, all of that, I think, also adds value in forging a very good relationship. And I think that, obviously, governments have to understand as well.
The appetite of the people of India, when they come to the United States, there are Indians who are in positions of great authority in corporations, technology, and otherwise, no question about it, in the arts, some a lesser extent in government positions, but some, and everything else. Some groups of representatives from other countries, when they come here, assimilate, and that's it. They're just part of the American landscape. Others want to stay together. We have here in Los Angeles, we can go to a Vietnamese community and find 7 Vietnamese restaurants on one block, and I promise you there will not be a deli. There will not be a deli or an Italian restaurant on that block, okay?
Yes.
And we can do the same in Chinatown.
Yes.
We can, and a few other areas. How do Indians who live in the U.S. Approach being here? Do they are they in a community, or are they totally and completely assimilated?
Both. I think it's both. As a matter of fact, there's a very strong Indian community in Southern California.
There is,
Los Angeles,
indeed,
and,
yeah.
And one particular area as well.
Which Where? What is the area?
Artesia.
Okay. Why?
Good question.
Probably one guy went to Artesia, yes. Liked it, his cousin came over.
And the restaurants are fantastic.
In Artesia?
It's like going home. The food
in Artesia.
Oh, my goodness, it's wonderful.
Because I was going to point out, you and I have eaten at one or two very fine Indian restaurants,
yes.
But they would be the only Indian restaurant in that whole area,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
For miles.
Yes, absolutely. I think the two things, honestly, in my opinion, that Indians cannot live without.
Okay.
Food and entertainment. There are something like 50 or 60 Indian channels in the United States.
Wait a minute. I want to get it. There are something like 50 or 60 Indian
television
TV channels in the U.S.
Yes.
Where does all the product for those channels come from?
Basically, comes off of satellite from the Indian channels in India. It comes into downlink on the East Coast, goes back up, and comes back down on various DTH services.
And Indians living here are watching those shows.
I know for a fact because it's in my house.
Yeah, but what do you do? Have a mix? You'll get a little bit of American, a little bit of Indian. I'll check BBC. Do you globetrot on your set?
I like watching Anderson Cooper. And my wife likes watching a lot of Indian shows. And you can get them in your language as well. You can get your language shows. So I could go back to Chennai, to my hometown,
right,
and watch the same soap opera that my mother watches and come back here and not miss a beat because my wife would watch the same show.
My goodness, that's amazing. Well, that's the blessing of technology.
Absolutely. You don't miss anything today. You can talk on the phone all the time. You can talk on video conferencing, and you don't miss anything. Yes, geographically, you're far away from India, a home country, but not as far as communication is concerned.
Well, you've done more than dabble in the world of entertainment yourself here as a performer, organizer, and what you're doing now in Asia. So you can't talk to anybody about India without bringing up Bollywood. So let's tell me, big picture, I understand there's a staggering amount of product that is generated. Tell me about the Bollywood scene.
Well, we use Bollywood as you use the name Hollywood here,
right,
sort of in a very general term. But Bollywood is entirely films that are made in Bollywood. And I would almost venture to say that the films made in Bollywood are less in number than the films made across the country in India and other languages.
So Bollywood is an area.
Bollywood is what the Americans have coined, or the Indians coined after Hollywood, to call it films made in Bombay.
I got it.
So they call it Bollywood.
But you have movies being made all over the country.
In Chennai, for example.
A large quantity of movies?
In Chennai, it's called Tollywood.
And how popular are going to movies
huge,
among Indians?
Huge.
How often? If you were back in Madras and you were a teenager, how often would you go to the movies?
I would go every weekend, like I do here as well. I'd go to the movies every weekend, constantly. And sometimes I see four movies on a weekend because I enjoy going to the movies. And as much as all of this, you know, input has come in on television and big screens and surround sound and all of that, I still like the experience of going with my friend or my wife or my kids to the movies and having a cup of coffee and discussing the film. And
the
so
social
and so
aspect,
I
sure.
love that bit.
Okay, if we go downstairs and we were to walk together for five blocks, I would be willing to mortgage the house and bet that 50% of the people we will see, particularly if we're in millennial land and we have the younger ones, would be texting or phoning or would have a mobile device doing its mobile thing. If we walk down the streets in Bombay or New Delhi, would I see anything comparable?
So just for numbers, and just broad numbers, obviously with a population of 1.3 billion, we have 900 million cell phones in India.
Hold back. We got to go back. The population of India today is 1.3 billion.
Yes.
And the population of the United States is, I think, 300.
Almost 300 million.
Almost 300 million. So we're talking about 3.6. Now we're talking about four times.
Yes. Population-wise, we are four times the size of the U.S., and two-thirds its geographical size.
Okay. And China's up to what?
China is
a little bigger.
They're definitely bigger, but we're supposed to pass them by 2020.
Yeah. That's in an hour and a half.
So, yes,
I mean, it is. 2020.
Yes, it is.
That's wild. All right. So now, how many cell phones?
900 million cell phones. Not all of them, by the way, are smartphones. I think the smartphones now are at 250 million, and it is being sold. It's number one market in the world, I think, if I'm not mistaken, for the sale of smartphones.
Wow.
So everyone wants to sell there, and the packages and the pricing and what's available and the communication. I think we went from 0 to 9 in a week. When America brought in mobile telephones, they went from 0 to 1 to 2.5 to 3. But we just jump-started the whole
thing. Has the online economy exploded in India as well?
Online shopping has gone through the roof. Every year, I think it doubles or triples. And it's all because of the data and the bandwidth available today. It's quite incredible.
Well, look, you saw what just happened in the U.S., the unprecedented amount of sales. Now, in the beginning, people would go online to check something out, and then they'd go to the brick and mortar to buy it. Now they don't bother to go.
Yes, and I know someone who tweets a lot as well now.
Yes, to say the least, we have the tweeter in chief.
Yes,
that he's the commander in chief and the tweeter in chief. Okay, is it 8 years or 9 years since you first established your foundation?
2006.
All right, so 10 years.
So it's been 10
wow.
years, and we've had 11 events over the years.
Well, first of all, what was your motivation, what was the mission, and what have you been able to accomplish?
Well, as you said in your introduction, I was very fortunate to serve as a messenger of peace for Kofi Annan's administration at the UN, alongside Muhammad Ali, Luciano Pavarotti, Michael Douglas, and the actor, and of course, Eli Wiesel, the Nobel laureate. And it was a wonderful experience to be sent to places that I wouldn't normally have gone.
Right.
And it wasn't London, New York, and Paris. So that gave me a great insight as to the incredible work the UN and their agencies do in different parts of the world and what they do when a disaster strikes. One of the first ones I went to was in 2001 when we had an earthquake in the western part of India, and how UNICEF hit the ground running within 24 hours of that tragedy taking place. And of course, we went in there 48 hours later. So when my term finished with the UN in 2006, end of 2006, we launched the Vijayamitraj Foundation with a bunch of our friends, and just with the thought process of saying, can we raise a little bit of money to help charities in India that don't have the ability to raise money or raise awareness for their programs, and every little bit would help. And with an ambassador to each of those charities, we also get an opportunity to go visit them on a regular basis.
Now, there is, of course, an awareness that the Bill Gates and the Warren Buffetts and the billionaires have big hearts in many cases, and India and its needs are certainly among those leading places, as well as in Africa, that their dollars are directed. So if they're doing that big stuff, what was the need for what you were trying to do?
Well, I think when you talk about the Gates Foundation and the amounts of money that we're discussing, as far as they're concerned, they actually look at the country as a whole, in a matter of speaking, where they're able to actually make a difference in research, to be able to create an environment where things, they're finding cures for things, which is just unimaginable, and what work goes into it, and what time goes into it, and what money is spent. What we are trying to do is work very closely with small causes on the ground where they are able to make a difference to lives. For example, last year we were able to do 200 eye transplants for children who are born blind.
Oh my.
And and I'm able to go visit the donor families and the recipient families. And the feeling you get when you see a mother holding a baby and the first time the child, he or she, looks up and is able to see the mother beats any tennis match I've ever won.
Of course. Oh, that's remarkable. And the money that you raise here, does it come exclusively from Indians living in the U.S.?
Oh, no. It comes from a cross-section of a variety of people. We have events. We've had golf events. We've had tennis events. We've had galas. But we want people to come and enjoy. We want people to network. We want sponsors to come on board. Sponsors who come on board are also seen on television on one of those channels.
Yeah,
which
right.
We put them on the Sony television network across the world. So they go to about 150 countries, which is wonderful for the sponsors. From a sponsor standpoint, it's very valuable. And at the same time, we work very hard to make sure that all of the money that people spend, whether it's a $100 raffle ticket or whether it's a ticket seat they buy, 100% of it goes to the cause.
A friend of mine runs United Way National, their development campaign. He told me that in the past couple of years, because of the economy here, many of the largest corporations have cut back on how much they were giving. It's not going to be 2 million, it's going to be 1.2 million. It's not going to be 1 million, it's going to be 200,000. But he said there's been a remarkable increase in the number of $100 donations. Ordinary people, the cab driver, the guy that works in the store, caring and giving is very, very much a part of the culture here.
Yes, but I also want to emphasize one very important factor here, Chuck, and that is the heart of the American people. The heart of this country is the largest I've ever seen. They are incredible givers, whether it's $50, $100, $10, $5, it doesn't matter. It's the greatest gift of all, I've always said, is the ability to give, the heart to be able to give, and to a great extent, how they are touched by it, the ability to give, and the fact remains that they want to be involved. So they get involved. They don't let something go by without making a comment. They get involved in it, and I think that's a great gift.
Earlier you mentioned a date of 1947, and that is when India reached its independence, right? Thank you, Mahatma Gandhi and everyone else. Now, you and I discovered recently something I don't think either of us knew much about, and that was actions taken in India, not in 47, but back in 43 and 42 when they were under British rule. And World War II broke out. And America was in the war. and America, Eisenhower was in charge over in Europe, and help was needed. And through the British Empire, they reached out and brought in a small, remarkable group from Burma. And they brought in others from different parts of the British Empire.
Myanmar today, though.
Myanmar, I got to get your names right. And then, of course, there was India. And what I was shocked to find out was that India responded with this volunteer army, a huge army in the millions, to assist not only in Asia, because they were on the Burma Road, but also in Europe. That was quite remarkable. And it's also, by the way, we, I think, agreed, it's a story that should be known and is not known. It would add to.
Absolutely, and I wasn't aware of it till you actually brought it to my attention.
Well, we're going to have to.
It's a story.
It's maybe a movie to be made. Who knows? But if that were to happen today, would the attitude in India be receptive? We're going in to try and deal with this Middle East problem. We need some additional. Would India respond?
Well, India has always been a great supporter of the UN, and we've always participated in all UN activities globally, and very much part of the UN peacekeeping force and all of that in different parts of the world. So I don't think that would be an issue at all. India is very much a part and parcel of that group. We still don't have a seat at the Security Council, and I think there is a point to be made there, because I do believe that times have changed over the last 30, 40, 50 years.
Is that based on population or attitude?
Well, they need to have a yes vote from all five present members sitting there.
Oh, boy. You want to join the club? We all have to agree.
All five.
Oh, boy. Well, I'm sure U.S. would agree. Britain, I'm sure. France? Probably. I have no idea how the Russians.
These are the permanent
feel.
Members of the Security Council. No vote.
Russia could veto it.
Yes.
Well, call Putin and Vladimir. Hi, it's Vijay. How are you?
Raise a glass and say Nastrovia.
Well, things could happen. That would be a very interesting. Oh, wait a minute! I just thought of something. Is China among the votes?
Yes.
Hello, you're out. They're not going.
No, I think people are understanding a lot more. We have an incredible, democratically elected government, obviously governing the largest country in the world from a population standpoint, democratic country by far.
By the way, you're the only person I know that refers to India that way, and it should always be referred to that way. The largest democratic.
Absolutely,
in the world.
No question. And the way we are a union, in my opinion, is so incredibly spectacular, because there are so many cultures, so many languages, so many religions, so many parts of India that are so different from one another. But we are all united as a people to be able to keep that democracy alive.
Which is why you haven't had the revolutions and the military dictatorships and the coups and everything else.
It's people have always said, I suppose the great names have said this before, democracy isn't the greatest thing in the world.
Better than all the rest.
It's what's second best.
Yeah, indeed. Let's talk about you and your future. What mountains are left for you to climb?
I don't know. I'm enjoying doing what I'm doing. I do a variety of things. I'm very involved in now with my son in the film business. He enjoys that. It's a creative art, as we look at it. I've always been very...
Are you producing?
Producing films.
Yeah.
And we've just done one, which we just completed. It's in post now. We're very excited about it. It's got a wonderful star by the name of Jamie Dornan in the lead.
Right.
Who was in 50 Shades of Grey and... Right. Now getting ready to play the new Robin Hood.
Right.
And Ben Mendelsohn, who won an Emmy for Bloodline, is the second lead in it.
We might as well do the commercial. What is the name of the film?
The movie is called Untogether.
Untogether. It's a good word.
Untogether.
And when will it be released?
In the summer. Next, okay. Probably before the summer.
Who is distributing?
We're working on that as we speak.
Okay.
There's a lot in this picture. Billy Crystal is in it as well.
Well,
along with Jennifer Grey. And so we've got it's a strong cast.
You brought her in for the other part of 50 Shades. Okay, good.
So we're good. So Prakash has been working very hard on the picture, my son. And he's very excited about it.
Is he the producer?
Yes.
And what are you?
My company's doing it.
I see. But you're in the background. He's out front.
I was out front, very much, and rightly so, because, you know, you want to have good-looking people out front.
and he is that. What about the hereditary continuation of tennis greatness? Can you talk about that, tennis and the Armitage family?
Well, we were very fortunate because we were my son and I, Prakash, was also number one in India. He played Davis Cup for us as well. So to go on from father to son was a remarkable thing for me to see, which I really enjoyed. He was on the tour for 11 years. Again, learned so much from his travel to the places and the countries that he'd been to and meeting people. And he has a global perspective on all that he does. And I think that's what the greatest thing from a sport, especially an international and a global sport like tennis, which I try to emphasize as much as I can to all of our tennis players of today, the young ones, both boys and girls, is to learn from it. Not just become a better tennis player, which is your pursuit of excellence, but to be able to learn from your travels and be educated with the people that you meet and the families that you interact with. Those things are vital for the rest of your life, which is the major part of your life,
sure.
Because by 30, 35, you're going to be sidelined.
In baseball, we had a fixed World Series. In basketball, there were scandals at two or three colleges about shaving points to help the betting odds. In soccer, all over the world, with the exception of the top matches, there are hints of payoffs and everything else. I don't think I've ever heard an accusation of impropriety in the field of tennis. Have you?
No. And
I've never heard anybody throw a match at Wimbledon.
Well, it doesn't. It's not worth it. At the end of the day, the prize money is heavy.
Yeah.
You cannot get any of the top names to do anything out of the way for the simple reason that, one, they are, you know, obviously very wealthy.
Right.
And to win anything is a big, big check.
Right.
So there's no reason to do anything else.
Right.
Ranking points make a big difference. And the ranking points for tennis is on a 12-month cycle, so you can't live on what you did 5 years ago. So as far as tennis is concerned, it's individual, it's clean, it's out there. Guy has a bad day, he has a bad day, and he loses. Injuries are going to take you out of the system for a while as well. Everyone faces that.
Right.
So I do believe that as far as the sport is concerned, it is arguably the cleanest one we have.
Other than McEnroe and his temper and, you know, getting more, I think, more kidded than accused about that. It's also an elegant roster of sports personalities. These are not, you don't pick up a paper. There's a former NFL player that was convicted yesterday of multiple rapes, okay? He's gone away. It happens ever. I don't ever remember picking up a disgraced, to be jailed soon, major tennis player.
No, thank God, and touch wood. But
yeah.
I think that I served as president of the ATP Tour Player Council for four terms, so
right.
I'm fully aware of how the operation works and what a global sport we are. Something like 80 tournaments in 65 countries on television worldwide,
right.
And non-seasonal. We're not a seasonal sport. It starts in January and finishes after Thanksgiving. So it's a long season,
right.
for the circuit, for both men and women. So when you look at our sport, there is no better place for a sponsor to be a part of because it's global on television,
right.
And every part of the world plays the sport.
Indeed.
So when you call it the World Series here, I see New York playing San Francisco. Is it as global as it should be with the World Series? Same thing with the Super Bowl, which is the highest selling commercial aspect of any sport in the United States.
I just remembered that I had a tennis experience that I don't think I've ever shared with you. Years ago, I worked with a company out of New York that represented Slazenger. And they very much wanted Jimmy Connors to switch and become their guy and their spokesman. And he wasn't sure. And I love the guy, and
yes.
He's great fun, and got to him and met with him, and he finally agreed to use and try the Schlesinger racket in the first matches in Wimbledon, but it would be a black racket with
yes.
Nothing on it, which was really rather wonderful because we got more attention when he finally decided, I like it, and they put the Schlesinger logo on it. Tennis has become an endorsement-type opportunity, not just for the racket and the shoes, but it has produced real stars. I mean, it's a big-money sport.
It is huge. It is absolutely huge. As a matter of fact, even when we played in the 70s and 80s, interestingly, the golfers were not making as much as the tennis players.
I know.
But today, the golfers make more.
Why is that?
Than the tennis players. I think the PGA and the World Tour in golf have done a remarkable job with sponsorship and with people. And I think Tiger Woods played a huge role in promoting
personally
as well. Just by the fact that he was the number one player in the world. And he also talked about the ability to be fit in golf, which you never associated with fitness.
Yeah, but on the other hand, tennis is so much more exciting to watch on television than golf. I mean, golf is so slow to watch on TV.
Well, you wouldn't get that from Arnold Palmer or Jack Nicklaus talking about it, or Gary Player. Let me tell you. But
I suppose that's very true. What about the integration of men and women in sport? Or is there a big future for mixed doubles? Do you see that as part of the tennis scene? Or will women be playing women?
Well, that'll always remain.
Why?
They're two different sports altogether. Completely different sports.
What does that mean?
If you took the males playing each other and the pace with which they strike the ball, and the women playing each other and the pace with which they strike the ball, it's arguably different.
Well, does the name Billie Jean King ring a bell? I mean, come on.
Yes, but again, you're really talking about chalk and cheese here.
Right.
But I do believe that they're both of these sports, which I call, it's the same sport, played two different ways.
Right.
But at the end of the day, you have to look at it and say, what is the entertainment value of each match?
Right.
And the entertainment value for a men's match, entertainment value for a women's match, and that's the way the prize money is paid out.
I have heard some really interesting discussion by parents who are still very upset about the tension, stress, and injuries that little guys get playing soccer, playing football.
Yep.
And I know some parents that have pulled kids out of Pop Warner and Junior because get in there and hit it
yes.
and go. It's not a good message. And some of them have pulled them over to tennis with great delight because I don't understand why anybody would not realize how much of a role fitness is
yes.
in tennis. Golf, okay, you got the cart. Maybe you don't have to be that fifth, but in tennis, you're earning it. I find it,
No question. And I think you start at a young age.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, your career is done by 30. And if you're lucky...
What's the minimum age for senior tennis?
Well, we don't have what we call senior tennis. They pick up anyone who's just left the tour.
And you become part of senior tournaments.
It's more exhibition than anything else. But unlike golf, where it can be extremely competitive.
Yeah.
Because the difference between a senior golfer and a tour golfer is just the length of the drive. The length of the drive, one guy can hit it 320, the other guy hits it 220. That's the difference.
And that's the only difference.
But otherwise, the competitive edge is there as you get to the green.
Interesting. He's Vijay Armitage. Tennis player, yes. Broadcaster, yes. Entrepreneur, yes. And global social philosopher with interesting views. I'm Chuck Ashman. We call the program Diversity American Style. Thank you for joining us.
You're listening to Diversity American Style with Chuck Ashman, only on LA Talk Radio.